Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories for this very special interview with Richard Dutcher, the father of Mormon cinema. I'm John DeLynn. Please bear with me while I make four short but very important announcements with regard to this interview. First, these interviews are not only available in audio format, they're also available in high-definition video with footage from Richard's actual movies at youtube.com/mormonstories. Please check them out if you can. They're quite amazing. Historical, even. Second, Richard is in critical need of support for his current film project called Triptych, so please visit the website kickstarter.com during the month of October 2010 to donate. Kickstarter is a site created to help fund creative endeavors, but it requires that the funding target be completely raised before any funds change hands. Each project is given a particular number of days to reach its funding goals. In this case, it's 30 days, so time is of the essence. To learn more about the Triptych project, listen to this full interview or visit the site and type in Triptych. Triptych is spelled T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H and or Richard Dutcher. That's kickstarter.com, K-I-C-K-starter.com. We will also have a link to Richard's Triptych fundraising page at richarddutcher.com. For those of you who do not own Richard Dutcher's movies, such as God's Army, Brigham City, or States of Grace, please consider supporting Richard's incredible filmmaking by buying the DVDs today at richarddutcher.com. That's D-U-T-C-H-E-R. These movies are fantastic, and you will enjoy these Mormon Stories interviews so much more if you've actually seen the movies. I can't recommend these movies highly enough. Finally, if you'd like to make a gift or investment to help Richard with one of his much larger film projects, including his much-discussed Joseph Smith movie, please contact him through richarddutcher.com or via Facebook. Again, the last name is spelled D-U-T-C-H-E-R. Let's do our part to help him make that Joseph Smith movie. It's his birthright. Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Take it away, Dan Witherspoon.
Well, let's get you back on the track of your career.
Okay.
So you're married by the time you graduate from BYU and all that right. stuff, and then you got us to the point where you're packing up your car and you're going to LA to right. really start it, and you've had Brother John in hand.
That's right.
So we're kind of at that point in the story.
And I've been trying to sell Brother John because, you know, obviously I had an investor, a real investor, and so I was trying to sell it so that the investor could get his money back. But we get to LA and we spend some time house sitting, and then we spend some time managing apartments. And in the meantime, Gwen starts working at a design advertising agency, and I started trying to get as many acting gigs, paid or unpaid, that I could get. Started writing a lot, both the novel and screenplays, and then started submitting my screenplays. And it was a really great time because I got to see how things work in L.A. And see again, I mean, it was reinforcement that the independent filmmaking route was really going to be the only route available to me. Because again, like I said, I think in the sense that I avoid groups, I'm not a, I don't do well in the Hollywood scene. I'm not a, you know, opposed, I can't, you know, do the brown nosing and the shoulder rubbing and all the, you know,
Not at home at cocktail parties. Not because of the cocktails necessarily, but just the chit chat.
Right. Yeah. The chit chat, the networking, the relationships purely for, you know, your professional gain. I could never really get into that, and I couldn't, you know, and I couldn't. The superficial parts of the industry, I couldn't consider important, and yet those are the things that, in some sense, are professionally important. But I couldn't do it. So. But at the time, I was starting to, you know, as an actor, I was just a young, mid-20s, white kid, very, you know, not overly good-looking, I was just average-looking. I thought I was a really good actor, but that's pretty secondary in L.A. And so I couldn't really get too far with the acting. And the writing, I was starting to make progress. I was starting to submit to contests and place pretty highly. And agents, you know, some agents were starting to circulate my scripts. But what I noticed was I kept meeting all these screenwriters who were 60, you know, in their 60s and had been at it their entire lives and had never had a film produced. You know, they'd even sold some. A lot of them were professional screenwriters who had sold scripts to studios that had then just been shelved, and so they'd spent their entire lives basically achieving nothing. And And I just thought, this is ridiculous. I can't do this, and I can't sit around waiting for an acting job. And so I just thought, you know, I've made this 10-minute film. I know how to do that. And, a 90-minute film is just 9 of those put together. And so I felt I can do this. You know, I felt confident. So that's when I decided I was going to make my first full-length film, and it was Girl Crazy. But it was a very long process. It was like I decided to do it while Gwen and I were managing apartments in Van Nuys, California. I decided to do it before then. No, that's right. I decided to do it there because I remember sitting by the pool after I'd been cleaning up at night and coming up with a story. I have to tell a story. You know, it has to be here. It has to be present day.
Of the budget.
Because I knew I wasn't going to have any money to make this movie. It was whatever I could scrounge together. And so it was going to have to be just something. So I'm thinking, well, I've got this apartment building. So what can I write around an apartment building? And I'm an actor. I can work for free. And I can write something where most of the other actors only have to be there for a day or two. And I had a friend, Tim, from Utah, who was a great actor. And I thought I'd bring him down to play a part. And anyway, so that's where the whole story was born, and Girl Crazy basically. And I wanted to kind of show off. I'd had a lot of success as an actor in comedies, and so I thought I could play the comedy up a bit. So a romantic comedy seemed like a good thing to do. So I devised this whole story about a man who loves women and has this apartment building and has filled it with women. And basically he just, whether they're young, old, black, white, doesn't matter, fat, skinny, he just loves women. And then some of them he loves a little too much, and then he actually falls in love, like deeply in love with one of the women, and he has to learn to commit to just her. And it's a sweet, you know, it's a very sweet story, and it was fun, but it was such a long process. You know, I immediately just went from friends and family to who do you know, and trying to raise money finally getting enough that I thought I could probably shoot the film. I think I'd raised about $14,000. And I brought out everything that I could, you know, all the documentation. Is like, but basically people were just investing in me. They were feeling like, okay, we think he can maybe do something.
And this is mid to late 90s?
This is, early 90s.
Early 90s, okay.
And so I eventually just started shooting. I pulled in. I'd never had a producer as a mentor, so I was basically just going off of what common sense. You know, it's like, okay, I've got to hire crew, so I just handled it as if I was just hiring anybody, doing, you know, calling people in and interviewing them and trying to gauge which ones would be really good at it. And of course, casting the actors was easy because I was an actor, and that was going to be just, you know, that was a piece of cake. I just found the good ones and spent a lot of time casting, and it was a huge cast. That was I knew it going in. Most people, when they make their first independent film, do something with like 6 people in a cabin, and I hated those kind of movies. I just hated them, and so I thought, I'm not going to do that. You know, so I kind of ambitiously had a cast of, I think it was 55, 60 people, and multiple locations, a lot of them around that. I tried to do everything within a couple mile radius of the place, try to get everything for free.
So did you film at the apartments that you managed?
Yeah. Okay. And so I went to the owner, property management company, and I kind of downplayed it because I just had to. I had the money and I had it all together, and I had to have the location. So I went to the property management team and I said, you know, this is what I want to do. It's just a little movie. It's no big deal. I'm just going to be shooting here for a week or so. And they said, oh, sure, go ahead and do it. But I was doing it, even though I had little money, I was stretching out as far as I could go. So, you know, the day that I'm going to shoot, I have a couple big trucks, and I've got a lot of people, and we just take over this apartment complex. And I'm using not only, you know, my apartment, and I had made some friends in the building, so we're using theirs. There were a couple empties that we were empty apartments that we were shooting in. So anyway, just descend on this place. And the tenants were pretty good about it for about 3 days, and then they started to really lose patience because we were shooting, you know, 16-hour days, and they were always walking around equipment, and parking was crazy. And so by about this time, the property management lady probably came a few days after that, so I remember her coming in the evening and walking in and just seeing this movie. I mean, it was a movie crew, you know. It was, and we had big lights, and we had all kinds. I mean, it was a you know, pretty big production. And she basically just fired me right then. but she knew that, and I said, "Well, I'm in the middle of this, and you gave me permission, and I got to finish, and so it's going to be a few more days." And she's like, "Well, I'll see what I can do, but I can't make any promises." And anyway, I was able to hurriedly kind of finish. But yeah, we basically shot the film and then packed up and left because I was fired. But it was so totally worth it. It was like, great. I had a cool location. but it was a great experience as far as it was that was really the graduate school of filmmaking because it was a big project. It was, you know, I had to raise a significant amount of money for me who had no money and not really, you know, no family members with money, no friends with money. It was really just me pounding on doors and picking up the phone and raising money. And then taking the project all the way through, you know, so getting it shot. And then, of course, there was no money again, so I had to go out and raise money so I could keep editing it. And in our next apartment, you know, one of the bedrooms was just completely my editing room. That was our bedroom. Gwen and our bedroom was also the editing room. So in the daytime, I'd have a guy in there helping me edit, and then he would leave. And at night, in fact, the big earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, happened while we were there, and all the everything came off the shelves, and so there was film all across the bedroom. But nothing was destroyed, gratefully. But then the whole process later, so, and then finishing it, and then having it finished, and trying to peddle it, and trying to get people to buy it, and it took forever. You know, it was really a long process, probably almost 5-year process by the time I finally found a distributor who had TV contacts, and then we were able to get it to HBO, and then HBO and Showtime, or HBO and Cinemax, bought it.
Which and so it never, it never had a theatrical release at
never
all?
Never had a theatrical release, yeah. It was. It went pretty much, hit a couple of markets, festival-type places, and then it went right to... actually, my first trip to New York City was taking that film to a market in New York, and which was the year after Clerks, and so everybody was still talking about Clerks. HBO picked it up and it played there.
And it was never released. For a couple of years, it was just in sort of a semi-regular rotation or whatever.
Yeah. And that was pretty cool, you know, even though, you know, we didn't make a lot of money on it, but, you know, I'd open the TV guide and I would see, you know, it would say something like, you know, Patriot Games, and then right after that, Girl Crazy. And it was cool. I mean, it was just undeniably cool because I'd pulled it off, you know, and I'd taken, and it was pretty difficult basically going from somebody with nothing and you just pull something together and you create it and you have, even though your faith falters in it, you just stick with it. And I didn't have any choice, you know, financially I had to stick with it, and then eventually it sold.
So they buy it, it's enough to pay off your investors?
Not quite.
Okay. So you really never made any money from this. This was just your
right
calling card from that point on. Look at what I was able to do for X amount of money.
Right.
You can trust me that I can pull off whatever project
I'm
pitching to you.
Okay. But one thing that did do for me was it made me very aware of the fact I just spent 5 years of my life on this project. And the thing that really struck me the most was that it was basically... And it's not, it's my least favorite of all the films I've made, just because it's not very well made, because I had hardly any money, and it was the film that I was kind of learning on, you know. So despite what people believe, filmmaking is a craft, and so you don't...
a little just jab there, right?
It is something that you have to learn. You're not just born to be, you know, you just don't, you know, come out of your mother's womb knowing how to make a movie and how to tell a story, you know, with a camera. And so... It was really where I learned, you know, it's like, okay, this worked and these things really didn't work, and I will never, ever, ever do that again because that doesn't work. And so even now, I mean, I watched the film a couple of years ago or a year or so ago, and there are things in it that are, you know, well done, but there are things in it that are just not. And so I've always thought about putting it out there as a creating a DVD, but more as a kind of a filmmaking 101 type thing where it's like show the film but then have a lot of extras on there where I'm saying, you know, these are the things that I did right and these are the things I did wrong. These are the things I learned. And these are the things that, you know, you need to make sure you, everything from the legal aspects to the production and the post-production and selling. So it could be valuable in that sense.
Well, but, I know this audience of Mormon Stories would be very. I've tried. We've been friends for 7-8 years, and I've talked to you about letting me see it a time or two, and you always are politely declining the chance. Does HBO and Cinemax still own it, or at a certain point
the license
is back to you and stuff?
Yeah.
So
yeah. So the only way I'd put it out there again would be in that kind of a
that sort of thing.
In that kind of, frame it in that way where it's like you know. I'd have to be very clear that this is not a great movie. It's got some good stuff in it, and there's some truly funny stuff in it, but I would have to frame it in, but there's a lot of problems here, and I know that, and here's what they are. And
well, you look at, I mean, just from what you said a little bit earlier, there's guys that write screenplays and 50, 60 years old, and they've never had a film produced. Even though you produced it yourself, like you say, there's this entity that sits out there now.
Yeah.
And you learned a lot. Now, I know you were heading, you started down one train of thought that I've heard you talk about before. This was 5 years of your life, and I know you transitioned from that saying, what's your basically your takeaway? I'm never going to spend 5 years of my life again on something.
So trivial. Yeah, something that's, because even if you like the movie, and if you do like it a lot, you're probably, you know, have pretty low expectations. But even if you like it, you walk away and it's like, it was fun, you know, it was 90 minutes of... You know, completely disposable, fun, and you'd forget about it. You know, nobody would, you know, be thinking about it the next day. And I just thought that's not worth 5 years of my life. And it's so, and everything, you know, the sacrifice, because Gwen and I were basically every dime we had would go into this film to get it, you know, closer to being done. So the amount of work and sacrifice and time and risk, you know, it put, you know, we had a very small little family that. Young family, and we were constantly on the brink of bankruptcy because trying to get this film made. And so the risk involved in everything, it was just like, if I'm going to do that again, and I am going to do that again, but next time it's going to be for something that means something, you know, that no matter what, if at the end of the road nobody wants to see it, nobody buys it, it completely fails financially, I will still be proud of it and still be glad I made it. And so that took us into the God's Army era.
So what's the gap? Girl Crazy finally hit the HBO airwaves when? And I know God's Army is in 2000, so.
I believe it, I have to check my facts, but I believe Girl Crazy hit in 1997 on HBO. And by the time it hit, I had already been trying to raise money for God's Army for a year or two. And so, and I took a break to do a little movie called Eliza and I with KBYU, which was a, well, it should have been a feature length project, but it was cut down to 57 minutes for PBS, you know, for KBYU. So I took a little detour to make that.
As a director for hire, or was this your own script as well?
No, it was, I had the concept of, well, it all came out of this period of, after Girl Crazy, after I'd made Girl Crazy and was still trying to sell it, and I realized that I needed to, you know, do something of substance with my life. And at that time, that I've spoken about a lot, and boy, I don't know if I really want to go into this again, but there was this whole period, kind of this spiritual reawakening that I experienced at that point when it was, and it was, you know, had a lot to do with the 5 years that I'd spent on Girl Crazy. But I was getting to this point where I was feeling like my life has to have some kind of meaning, you know, professionally. I mean, it had a lot of meaning just personally with my marriage and my first son. But I was reexamining things. And if you go into my early, when I was speaking about this shortly after God's Army, there was a real tension always within me between filmmaking and my Mormonism, or my spirituality, I should say, because I always felt like they weren't working together. It was like I either felt like I could be a filmmaker or I could be a good Latter-day Saint, and I wanted to be both, but I never really, it always felt like they didn't, you know, it's just like when I got to be 19, instead I had to leave filmmaking and go be a missionary, and I couldn't spend any time being a filmmaker while I was a missionary. So it kind of set you up that way, you know. And also in the church, of course, there's all this, Hollywood is always seen as this, you know, the...
It's Babylon, man.
Yeah, it's Babylon. So how could you do that? And it, so in my mind, there was always that problem, and they always fought each other. They always kind of didn't go along. And so when I got to that point, when I realized that I wanted to do both, then I, when I realized that I wanted to do, well, actually after Girl Crazy, there was a period where I felt like I couldn't. When it came right down to it, and I thought I can either be a good Latter-day Saint or a filmmaker, and I always referred to this as my Abrahamic sacrifice because I really felt like I couldn't, you know, because the experience with Girl Crazy had kind of reinforced that because I had made it for a mainstream audience, and I was never very, you know, prudish or any. I was always willing to kind of, you know, stretch things, and I was willing, you know, I didn't care about ratings, and I didn't care. I just wanted to tell a good story, tell it well, and I didn't care if it was a little naughty. In fact, I probably wanted it to be a little naughty because, you know, the marketplace would, you know, probably it'd probably do better in the marketplace if it was naughty. It turns out that was true, but I kind of felt like I was falling into this pattern. I couldn't do that. I couldn't, you know, and I was going to have to push it further, you know, in order to succeed. And, you know, and I just was at that point where I couldn't reconcile the two. And I really felt like what was required of me was to make a decision. So once again, just like I had done earlier when I decided to leave my, you know, filmmaking obsession and go be a missionary, I felt that once it was required of me to put this behind me and go do something else, be a teacher, be a doctor, be anything else that would allow me
because
to be
a... Because the Mormonism was the larger voice in your head saying, this is right. What I should do. And so Eliza, so tie this back into the Eliza film.
Well, okay, but it ties in more with Falling, actually, that, because there was actually a period where I got to the point where there was a conversation that my wife and I had in bed one night, late at night, and she... I was obviously upset, and she could tell that I'd been crying silently, and asked me what was wrong, and I told her. And that conversation is almost verbatim of what you find in the film Falling, where I was basically saying, I've just spent, you know, 5 years of my life or more, and I've accomplished nothing. You know, and I used to be a good person. You know, I was a missionary. I was doing these good things, important things, and now I'm spending my life in trivial, pointless, you know, pursuits. And it was really a turning point for me. And that's when I kind of redirected my energies back and said, okay, I'm going to be a Mormon, but I'm going to be the best Mormon since Joseph Smith. I mean, I was like, this is it. And so I really thought I was giving up filmmaking, and it was really one of the most difficult decisions of my life because it's hard for me to describe how much I love filmmaking. I mean, from being a child, and it's been one of the prime motivations for getting up in the morning, you know. It's like I love something about cinema, I love, and being something about being a filmmaker, I love. And so it was really the hardest decision. It was like, okay, for the sake of my God, I'm going to give up what I love the most. And man, it was difficult. And I did, you know. It was like I recommitted myself to a church, and these people didn't know what hit them in Burbank at the time. I was about as passionate as anybody could be, and I started... And there was one day in particular after... I only had to give it up for a few months, as it turned out, because I was out... Of course, even though I'd given it up, I was still very interested. So every Friday, I would get the LA Times, Fridays and Sundays, and read about what movies were opening and the reviews about them. I was always, of course, still very interested. And there was one day, it must have been a Friday, when I was out on the porch with the LA Times spread out, and I was out barbecuing hamburgers for Gwen and the boys. And I was reading about the movies that were out there, and there was this moment, I was looking, and there was like an Indian movie, not an American Indian, but, you know, the India Indians.
Bollywood.
Yeah.
Pre-Bollywood, I guess.
That had just opened, and there was, you know, the gay cinema had just really taken off, and so there were a couple gay-themed movies, and there was, you know, for black, there was a movie that would primarily interest, you know, a black audience. And I was looking at this, and I remember being, I was frustrated, and I was thinking, you know, you don't have... why can't Mormons do this? You know, the blacks, the Indians, the homosexual community, everybody's doing this. Why can't Mormons do this? And it just hit me. I mean, it was just like the clouds parting for me. And I literally sat down because it hit me so hard. And it was like, why can't we do this? This is, you know, I think at the time there was over 10 million Mormons in the world. At least that's what the church was pronouncing. And and I thought, well, that's plenty enough to, you know, if you make a good movie that would interest them, they would absolutely go see it. And Mormons, unlike Pentecostals, you know, they don't have any issues with movies. Mormons love movies, love going. They also love complaining about, you know, movies, but they do go, you know. It's like there's nothing against going. Anyway, I got instantly, and I knew instantly that it would work. You know, it's just like, this will absolutely work. And I immediately started to remember these talks that, you know, Spencer Kimball had given. I later, you know, I didn't know them well enough to know it off the top of my head, but I went and researched and found out he had given this talk called The Gospel Vision of the Arts. It was back, I believe, in 1977. And he'd done it like, he'd also done it like 10 years before, so like 67, he'd done it as an apostle, 77 as a prophet. But there's a lot of material of him just basically saying, yeah, these are great stories, go out and tell it. And of course, I learned later that a lot of people were very familiar with this, the arts community in Mormonism, which I was not really a part of. I was more a part of the independent film community in LA than I was the arts community in Mormonism. And but I immediately started to think, okay, what kind of stories can you tell for Mormons? And there was just a myriad. I mean, at first it was a little difficult trying to find the story. But the first one I came up with was just knock it out of the park. It was absolutely, I was never able to make it because I called it a restoration Western, which it was basically a Western set around the 1844 in Nauvoo. And it was this great, I mean, it had all the feelings of a Western and the excitement, but it was also very much tied into the restoration of the church and the migration of the saints and everything that was happening in Illinois at the time. And it was called True Believers, and it totally kicked ass. And I immediately went out, and I started writing like crazy. And I went out and started putting out feelers to raise money for this, because to me it was like, this thing is going to be huge. But even with my independent, you know, filmmaking experience, where I knew I could make things really inexpensively, Girl Crazy ended up costing, I think, total, like delivering it to HBO, was like $55,000. So that was pretty inexpensive for a feature film. But I knew even with this thing, which was a big Western, you know, which have all the horses and carried in a cast and all the wardrobe and everything. And I knew it was probably, even with my frugality, it was going to cost maybe $2.5 million. But still the numbers worked out. You know, I did all the numbers about all the Latter-day Saints, how many people would go. And I went out there and I started meeting with people. But after 4 or 5 months, I just realized that the number was just too high. Nobody believed that it would work in the first place, but I realized that if I was going to do this, I was going to have to scale it way back, and so that's where I went back and I said, okay, this is going to be another Girl Crazy. It's going to be like, I'm going to have to do it for maybe $50,000, which means it's going to have to be present day, it's going to have to be LA, it's going to have to be, I'm going to have to be in it, and I'm going to have to talk people into working for free, and what can I tell in those parameters that Mormon audiences would like to see? And then that's where it came out that I thought, hey, a missionary story. Nobody's told a real story about missionaries.
Part the curtain and let's see what happens on a mission. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, what could, like, if you approached it like an independent film, so it would have the aesthetics of an independent film, but it would be about the Mormon missionary experience. And nobody seemed interested in telling that story, and I thought I was really well suited to tell it because I knew it. You know, it was my story, and that's when everything started to kind of tumble together. At that point, and I went, "Oh, you know, of course. Why wasn't I thinking of this? You know, 7-8 years ago, I could have done this instead of Girl Crazy." And of course, they're always saying, "Write what you know." So why was I off trying to? You know, I was writing vampire movies and these romantic comedies instead of writing the things that nobody else was interested in telling and that very few people would be able to tell anyway. And so I got all excited about it. But interestingly, it was a very difficult process of getting the film written because, again, it was kind of the first of its kind. And in my mind, I had all the pollution of all the church media that I had watched growing up. And I consider it pollution in the sense that it kind of dictated a certain aesthetic and a certain approach and a There were obviously certain things you didn't talk about and certain things you did talk about. And so it really took a while for me to get that out of my head. You know, it's like I have to get that out of my head. And it took me several drafts of the screen. In fact, I remember thinking, okay, I've got this screenplay. It's really, I feel like it's there. You know, it's ready to make. And it was really somewhat similar to what the film finally became. But in that story, the main character, Brandon Allen, was a baseball player who had given up his, you know, chance to go play in the minors to go on a mission. And so that was the big struggle. And it was basically the same characters, but a lot more soft kind of approach to it. And Gwen, actually, I credit her with the one that really got me thinking right, because she read it, and she's always the first one to read everything. And she read it, and she goes, yeah, it's good, but there's just not a lot of you in it. And I really sat back and started thinking about it, and she was absolutely right. You know, it was like there were things I was holding back, and I think a lot of that was the fact that this programming that I had in my brain from all the church media, that there are certain things you didn't talk about. And I realized that I was telling a missionary story without taking my own life, you know, my own mission, what was real in my life, and putting it into there. And so that's when I went back into it, and I was like, okay, the baseball thing is garbage, you know, forget that, that's cliched, and what am I going to give this guy, you know, what is it that's in it? And I thought, ooh, boy, let's just go for it. My stepfather was still alive at the time, but I remember thinking, once I really understood what the movie was going to have to be, it was like, okay, am I going to be a coward and be safe, or am I going to just jump right in and tell it the way it is? And so I just thought, oh, what the hell, let's just tell it the way it is. And so I started investing a little bit of myself in all the characters. And so there's a lot of me in Brandon Allen, the stepfather who becomes a child molester, and you know, that's taken directly from my life, and him finding out about it so late in life. And then, you know, so having the real father that took off when he was 7, which we've already discussed, so that was me, and the stepfather who was a child molester, that was me. Well, I wasn't the stepfather. I was the son of the stepfather.
And there was no... You were never molested by your stepfather or anything,
no,
right?
Yeah, no, he liked 12. Girls, which I guess I'm grateful for in an odd way. But anyway, so no, I never had to... That I never had to deal with that, thank God, because he was a big guy. I mean, he was a big man, and if that had been his inclination, then I certainly would have been a victim. So I thank God for that. That I avoided that. And
so back to investing more of your story in there.
Yeah.
In
so the characters. That jumped into there, and then of course going into the there were things that had always concerned me. So I started injecting some. Discussion of blacks in the priesthood. I started injecting a little mention of women in the priesthood, blacks in the priesthood. Of course, the anti-Mormon literature, the character that's really struggling with that. And, you know, I'd had my struggles with that as well as a missionary. Actually, as a missionary is when I first came in contact with the real hardcore anti-Mormon literature. And had some real struggles with it, and also finding out that a lot of what they were saying, although had their particular spin on it, their particular ugly spin on it, there was still some truth there. And so it was really disconcerting to be learning some truth from such a source and it having been something that was completely ignored by my own, leaders and scholars. But anyway, so yeah, that was a real turning point in the story. And so I was able to do a couple more drafts while I just basically got really personal and let it go. And then went out as I was doing this, of course, I was trying to raise money as I was going along. So everything about the movie changed. It was originally called, it's a terrible title, I originally called it White Fields.
The field is white right at the heart.
Yeah, yeah, okay. White Fields, terrible title. Uh-huh. And at some point it became God's Army, and then so the process of writing it, raising money, was again same kind of excruciatingly long process. And even though, you know, I was trying to make it for, I think I was raising $250,000, $300,000. And I could, you know, I had the numbers all. I was getting to be a pretty good businessman by this time, and a salesman, because I could lay out all the numbers and say, look, you know, if I can't even remember how many it was, but there was a certain number of living returned missionaries. And I said, okay, forget about the whole church, but just if the people who actually served a mission go see this movie, it's going to make a ton of money. And if nobody else sees it except people who actually had the experience, just like, you know, you make a movie, make Platoon, and of course a lot of soldiers, a lot of people from Vietnam are going to want to go see it. So it just seemed like a no-brainer to me. It's like, there's no way that this cannot succeed. And even after, you know, I do this, I'm meeting with as many wealthy Mormons. If there's a wealthy Mormon, I probably met with them. But I learned an interesting lesson, which was I had the wrong approach, because I'd lay out the business numbers, but my main sales pitch was kind of a missionary sales pitch. It's like, this is something that we need to do. You know, this is important. This is something that's going to do some good in the world. This is something that God would want us to do. It was basically that approach. And I learned that businessmen don't care. I don't care who it is. I don't care, you know, how prominent they are in the church. That sales pitch did not work. You know, they're going to do some good with their money. They're going to send it to Salt Lake and let them do some good with it. Well, all they really were concerned about was making money.
Or a reasonable chance to get my money back.
Yeah, well, it had to be far better than reasonable.
They wanted that, okay.
Yeah. But I fortunately, a couple of people finally, well, one, this and this will play into the story later on. One guy who was a great guy, Craig Earnshaw in Park City, was the first person to really, well, the first investor was a Christian Science lady that really kept things going. I was able to, you know, have enough money to keep raising money because of her investment. And then Craig Earnshaw in Park City was the first significant investor that actually was like, okay, I think I can get this made. And I think he responded. He's an excellent businessman, so he definitely saw the business potential. But I think he also recognized that I was trying to do something good. You know, I was really, aside from doing something smart business-wise, I was really trying to do something good, and he could be down with that. So he helped out a lot. And then I had another investor who was talking about investing, but never really knew it. And I decided to take the investment that I had and just start doing it, because I'd kind of learned this approach from my own experience with Girl Crazy, but also I'd read Francis Coppola, which is basically had the same philosophy. And I thought, well, hey, if Francis Coppola is, you know, if he agrees, then there must be something to it. And basically it's just, you just start doing it, you know, even if you don't have the money, you just start making it. And so that's what I did with Girl Crazy, and was able to at least get it shot. And if I'd waited to get the whole budget, it never would have happened. So, and then with God's Army, it was like I had enough that I thought I could get through the shooting. And so I just started. You know, I just started shooting it. But it was obviously, again, this was only my second film, so there were a lot of expenses that I didn't really anticipate. And the way that I shoot, it became very apparent after the experience with Girl Crazy, where I would do just a couple of takes and then move on because that's all the money I had. And later I realized I will never, ever, ever, ever do that again, because I will never walk away from a scene until I feel like I've got it down. And I don't care if that, you know, I don't care if it screws up the schedule. I don't care what it does. I will never walk away from a scene until I feel like I've got it. And so going into God's Army and also realizing, you know, if this film didn't work, it would probably be my last film that I would ever make, you know. And so I wanted it to be good. As good as it could be, given the limited resources that I had. And so I went into it, and by the time we were about halfway through the filming, and I realized that the money was quickly going to be gone, and I wouldn't have enough to get it finished. And of course, you know, then the cast and everybody would just go their separate, and I just knew that I would never get it back. And so I'm shooting and trying to raise money at the same time. And there was one day in particular when we were completely out of money, and it was the scene, we were doing the diner scenes when the missionaries are all sitting around the diner, and so I was having to perform, but I was also waiting for an answer from a particular investor. And if the answer was no, I would have been completely done. I mean, I would have had to go out to the crew the next day and just say, guys, I just don't have any money to finish. And I would have had half a film. And so here I am. I just remember the stress of being in that situation and sitting at this table and trying to perform the scenes and direct the scenes. In the meantime, you know, listening to the film roll through the camera and the money that was going through.
Cha-ching, cha-ching.
And knowing that this might be it and this might be the end of the movie right here. And so when I watch that scene to this day, that's what I, those scenes in that diner, that's what I see. And I'm actually amazed when I watch myself and I'm like laughing in the scene and I'm like, I don't know how I pulled that off, because my, you know, I was getting a 3-inch ulcer in my stomach as this day was progressing. And
but you got the good news that very day?
Yeah, I got the news that day. I stepped out while we were shooting that thing. Shooting that scene, and got the phone calls like that this investor was coming in, and it was going to be enough to not only finish shooting, but it would be enough to finish the whole movie. And so
I want to share that person's name, that hero's name, or
yeah,
not,
it's Blake Roney.
Okay,
Blake Roney, from New Skin, and he just really saved the day on that. And going back in, And then the evening scenes that we were shooting, of course, I knew that, okay, I have the commitment. I didn't have the check yet. So the next day was when they were going to FedEx the check. So I guess it was 2 days later was the day that we were doing the scenes, the healing scenes, when Benny comes out. And
yeah, I'm wondering a little bit if we've kind of just assumed a familiarity with the film that we shouldn't have by this point. Uh-huh.
Everyone should have seen this film by now. Yeah. If you haven't, then go to MainStreetMovieCo.com, 1995.
Or we can buy it in the pack of three. So Benny is a character in it who's a recent convert, or he's about to join the church.
Right, right.
And he gets beat up.
Right, and okay. He's ill and he's bent. So he's ill, so he's already crippled, and then he's beaten up. And it's one of the key moments, one of the climaxes of the film is when Elder Dalton and Elder Allen go to. It's kind of when things get really down to the nitty gritty. It's like what they really believe, what they're really willing to, how far are they willing to go with their faith. And beautiful, to me, it's a really beautiful scene. But that was another one where that night was the night where you never. And when you're raising money for a film, you never know. And people, I have the craziest things happen. I have people say that they're at the bank wiring me the money, and it doesn't, and they're not there, and it never arrives. And you just think, why would you say that?
Yeah,
and so you never, even after the papers are signed, it's like until you have a check, and until the check clears in the bank, you never really know that you've got the money. And so it was that night that we were doing that when Benny walks out, and there was chaos on the set because the production manager was going insane that day. And it was just the craziest, most stress-filled day. And I'm surprised when I watch it now at how peaceful and pretty and beautiful it is, because it was all just complete chaos. People screaming in the background. In fact, I've got takes which will probably never see the light of day, but it was just, you hear this production manager screaming at Matthew, the actor, and then just moments before he has to, do his scene. It's just complete chaos. But that was the day that we actually got the check, and I could see it, and it was in my hand, and I was like, oh, I can finish this film. And then from then on, it was just a complete joy. There were the usual struggles and insanities of production that I had to deal with, but at least I knew that I had the money to get the film finished and made. So yeah, that's something. Those two investors, Blake Roney and Craig Earnshaw, were so incredibly instrumental in getting the film made. Mm-hmm. And so, I owe them a great, a lot of gratitude for that.
I do want to move us into, and I'm not 100% sure this is exactly the right spot for this, but I do want to, now do 10 minutes of Richard Dutcher speaking to a film audience or a group of filmmakers or something and say, here was my vision, here's what I set out to do, here's what I think went well, here's what I didn't think went well. We'd love to see more of the, you know, what were your goals, and especially if there are any memorable scenes that you'd want to talk about, saying this is just one of my favorite scenes and why, and things like that.
Okay.
So if you're ready to do that now with God's Army, I'm going to want to do it with all the films that we're going to go through.
I will do that. Let's go back first, though. I realize that was a long segue. You asked me about Eliza and I.
Oh, yeah.
And this became a segue.
I kind of remember that 15, 20 minutes ago myself.
But where that came from was as I was raising money for God's Army, and there were a ton of ideas that I had. Once I, you know, I had the True Believers idea, which was the big Western, and then the God's Army thing came along. But in between that, I also thought there were some great ideas for very small films. And one of the things I just wanted, it just occurred to me, one of the things I wanted to do was to take a one-person show and actually do an interesting job with it. Because usually somebody do a one-person show and it's just, you know, three cameras and it was very stagey. And so I just had this concept, before I even knew what show I wanted to do, of where you'd take a film that would start off as a documentary and then it would be kind of like a documentary about the subject, and then suddenly the actress is talking about the character, and then you follow her on stage, and it becomes a stage show, but then it gradually becomes a film. So by the end, the audience and the stage are gone, and it's an actual movie. So I just thought mixing all of these different forms would be really fascinating. And so what I did was I went out into the community, the Mormon community at that point, and I was just like, what's a good play? And there were several one-person shows. Most of them were already spoken for, but then Elizabeth Hansen, who was an actress and a writer, and she was teaching at BYU at the time, I believe. And she had this show that she'd just finished, and it was about Eliza R. Snow, which was right down my alley because I always loved church history. And so I knew who Eliza R. Snow was. And so I met with her and just said, hey, this is what I want to do. Can I have the rights? She said, yes. I paid her a little bit of money. I can't imagine it was much. It was probably like $100 or something. So I had the rights, and so I was out trying to get that going. But then the interesting thing that happened was KBYU went to her and said, hey, we want to tape your show. And she said, well, that'd be great, but this guy named Richard Dutcher in California, they didn't know who I was, you know, has the rights. And so KBYU said, well, we want to do this. And I said, well, you can't because it's mine. And they said, well, should we meet? And it was Sterling Van Wagenen who I had known briefly, you know, but not really at all. And so I got together with Sterling and a guy named Dave Monson, who was head of production over there, and sat down with them and basically said, well, this is the way that I'm going to do it. And I pitched the concept. And they really liked it, you know, and said, well, great, that's cool with us, we'll do it, we'll put up the money if you'll do it. And I was like, great, I'll do it. And so that was just a project that was in between, and it was a good experience in the sense that I had, they weren't going to give me much money for it, but I still insisted that we shoot it on film. And then I think I had 8 days to shoot the entire thing, and it was a feature length project. And so I'm very, I really like this film. Hardly anybody has seen it, and it's not everybody's cup of tea, but it does exactly what I was trying to do, which starts off with the actress-writer, Elizabeth Hansen, as herself, talking about Eliza R. Snow and visiting her grave in downtown Salt Lake, and then we're in her office as she's talking more about her. Then you see her getting ready to go on stage, and we follow her on stage. And then there's an audience there, and she's performing. And then at a certain point, I actually pulled the audience away, so they kind of drop into the blackness. And then the set slowly becomes real. And so by the end of the film, and we start doing flashbacks that are real, you know, cinematic flashbacks with, you know, horse, you know, out on location. And by the end of the film, we're actually in Eliza R. Snow's attic bedroom in Nauvoo, and she's at the window, and we pull back, and you see Nauvoo with you know, people and horses and wagons, and I think most people who see the film, I was trying to be very subtle, but I think maybe I was too subtle because nobody ever noticed. It was kind of like, did you not notice that I just started off with a documentary and went into a stage show and ended with a film? Nobody noticed. So I was always very proud of it. And
BYU left you alone pretty well as far as the script and everything. You felt like you had good cooperation.
Yeah, it was Liz Hansen's script, and I didn't add a word to the script. Okay. You know, it was her thing. Okay. And so I just came on as a director with a certain concept of how to tell it. And
Sterling Van Wagenen, just for listeners who don't know who he is, he won an Academy Award.
Sterling was one of the founders of the Sundance Film Festival, right. And then he's been a producer and a director and a writer. And his
Trip to Bountiful.
Trip to Bountiful was he was a producer on the film.
Right.
So that was an Academy Award-winning film. And
then I know his sister Lola. Is it his sister Lola that was married to Robert Redford?
I believe. Yeah, I don't know the
stuff like
the
that too,
family
but,
too well. But he's.
But now Sterling is back, and he's again heading up all of KBYU,
right.
And the different stations at BYU.
So right. And he's just a first-class human being. So it's just a real. It was a real pleasure to work.
Yeah, I enjoy him. Very
Aside
much
from
too.
That film, just it was a pleasure to work with him, and I grew to really love him. You know, he's just a wonderful person. And but the craft it was a great exercise for me because I literally had no time for any coverage, so I couldn't shoot a scene from two three different angles and edit it together because I only had 8 days. I had to have every single shot mapped out in my mind, and so I was literally shooting, you know, linking one shot to the next as I was shooting it, so that the editor would then be able to just go in basically and just link it all together like a chain, and there would be your movie. The interesting thing about that is where I also learned how. Subjective film is where I, when I finished this, I realized it's like I was delivering, okay, here you go, guys. I thought this would be the easiest thing in the world to cut together because there was no coverage, and it was just like you had to literally link it together, and I turn it over to them, and I go back to L.A. and turn it over to an editor that I thought nobody could screw this up, and I get a call back from Sterling saying, yeah, the footage, I guess there's a problem with it, and I said, what's the problem? And their editor said, that it was uncuttable. It was a complete mess. This guy doesn't know anything about directing. And I, of course, instantly was like, whoa, what? What are you talking about? And so I get in my car, drive up to Salt Lake, and I sit down with this editor, and I'm thinking, maybe I did screw up. You know, maybe I really... And then this guy was the most incompetent editor I've ever seen in my life. He was on staff at KBYU. And he was doing the craziest thing where he would cut... You know, I'd given him these, you know, overlapping movements where, you know, her movements, you could cut on her movement, it would be a seamless cut. And he was cutting instead of, you know, like she would be at a chair writing and stand up, which would be the obvious point to cut. But he wouldn't do that. He would wait and then she would be still and then he would cut and then she would get up. It was just awkward cuts through the whole thing. So I had to sit down with him. I just say, all right, let's, okay, and I would show him exactly where to cut. We're going along. So I'm finally sitting down, putting this movie together, and it's all working just as I had planned. And there was one moment in particular I remember where there was during a flashback, and we were at the computer, at the console, there were a couple of monitors, I believe, and so I was showing him how to go from the live action into the flashback. It was a perfect little transition where I think the actress, Janice Power, was reaching for a door, and it was a shot where you went from her in the present day, as in Nauvoo, reaching for the door, and then you cut to her reaching for the doorknob in the past. And it was just, I mean, again, it was a no-brainer. So I had it exactly where I wanted. I get a phone call. I pick up the phone, and I can't remember if it was Sterling or somebody on the phone. So I'm only talking for like 3 minutes. I'm on the phone talking. I lean back, and the editor says, okay, I fixed it. And I was like, what? You fixed what? And so we go back, and he had taken this perfect cut and turned it incomprehensible again. And so I was, and I was not a swearing man at the time, but.
And here we're talking cut on film, right? So he's actually made this cut.
No, okay. It's still electronic. We shot on film, but we were cutting
right.
electronically.
So that's at least a little better.
But I literally had to sit there and, you know, to salvage my very young reputation, you know, these people, this was the first time anybody in Utah was working with me. In order to salvage that, I had to sit there and basically make every single cut with this guy and do it diplomatically because I wasn't going to get another editor. He was the KBYU guy, and so trying to still be friendly while telling him that he's completely incompetent.
So before we leave Eliza.
Yeah.
Is it available? How could somebody see it if they were really persistent?
It's. I do believe it's available. I do believe that it's available through Covenant. I believe Covenant has a DVD with, I think, 4 short films on it. And even though this is an hour long, I think it's included on that. So I think it's available through LDS Bookstores via the Covenant. Search Eliza and I.
Eliza and I is the
right.
title. Okay.
And it was. I've seen it advertised as being one of my student films, and it's not. It wasn't one of my student films. It was something I made afterwards.
Okay. Good. All right, if there's enough energy left, let's finish our discussion of God's Army.
Okay.
Are you comfortable taking what I suggested and just talking about it as a project, your goals for it, what was realized, what wasn't realized,
yeah,
favorite scenes, things like that?
Well, what was important to me about that was from the moment I conceived the idea of Mormon cinema, and I conceived the idea of Mormon cinema before I conceived the story of God's Army, because like I said, I immediately went into what can I tell. I came up with the Western, and then eventually had to bring my expectations down and do something small. But from the very beginning, it was just like, I know this is going to work. I just know this is going to work. If I can tell a good enough story, and I can tell it inexpensively enough, it's going to work. In fact, I remember telling a friend when I was in this whole time I was out raising money, I believed in it, and my wife believed in it because she believes in me, but nobody else believed in it. You know, I mean, I'd be at church, and the elders' quorum president or the bishop or whoever would say, "What are you working on?" "Oh, I'm making this movie about missionaries." And people told me later, they said they actually thought I was brain damaged because they thought, "Why would anybody tell a story? Who would go see a movie about missionaries? Why would anybody make it? If he makes it, nobody's going to go pay to see this movie." But I knew they would, and so I just kept plugging away and plugging away and trying to raise money and trying to raise money and basically forcing it into being. And willing to take the risks that I'd taken with Girl Crazy, doing it all over again, where, you know, my wife and I were just putting everything that we had into it. And there were some crazy, you know, just crazy times when I should have given up, but I just knew I couldn't. I'm a fairly stubborn person and tenacious, but also there was a real sense of mission with this, because people have asked me, is like, were you trying to start a movement? It's like, absolutely. I was absolutely trying to start a movement, because to me it wasn't just God's Army. It was going to be 100 films about Mormon history and doctrine. They were going to get bigger. You know, they weren't going to get smaller. They were going to get bigger and smarter and better, and the production values would get better and it'd be deeper, and we'd all get better as filmmakers, and it would just be something that would. And I really felt like what I saw in cinema was that nobody was interested in spiritual filmmaking. There were a few people here and there, most of whom I didn't even know about. I didn't even hear about. I never learned about it at BYU. I don't know if it was an aversion to showing cinema about other religions. I don't know if that's what it was, or if they were just ignorant as well. But to me, I just thought, I instantly saw that this could work, and I also saw that because nobody else was interested in making films about human spirituality, that if they were made correctly, made right, and made well, that could be, you know, the source of spiritual cinema could be Mormonism. I was on fire with this idea, and it kept me going. You know, I really felt like, and I would read the Spencer Kimball talk whenever nothing was going right, and I would read a talk by that one apostle, what's his name, Elder Ballard, who also was at that time was an inspiration to me. And I would use these as like, this is something that God wants done, you know, and nobody else is doing it. And okay, I'll do it, you know. And so I was really filled with purpose and passion and mission. And I told a friend that what I was saying was, I remember telling a friend, we were in Glendale, I think, watching a movie, and I just said, there's a line, I can't remember what the movie was for. There's some Hollywood movie and there's a big line for it. And I told him, I go, there's going to be that kind of a line for God's Army in Salt Lake City. And they made fun of me and mocked me. And I said, okay, I'm telling you, it's going to be, you know, this is going to work. And he reminded me of this after the film had been a success. But yeah, I went into it just fearlessly, because I knew that I didn't know how long it would take, but I knew that it would work. And I was actually worried. One thing that hit me was when I was having such trouble raising money, and there was one night when I just thought, somebody with money is going to beat me to this, because I'd been out there telling the idea enough that I knew that it was, you know, somebody, you know, some Marriott or some Huntsman or somebody was going to go, hey, this is a great idea. And I knew that I would be sitting in a movie theater and I would see a trailer for a movie about Mormon missionaries and I would just explode, you know, because I'd invested everything and it was just like, and it was, I'd been working on it so long. And so that kept me going too. It was like, not only, you know, was there a sense of mission, but there was a sense that it was inevitable and somebody was going to do this. And if it wasn't me, then I was just going to explode. So that added an urgency to it. And we already talked about how eventually I got the one investor and was able to just start, and then it happened. And the really interesting thing about it was all happening in L.A. Nobody in Utah knew anything about what was going on. And so when I did finish the film, and my wife and I just knew that I was going to be spending the next 6, 8, 9 months pushing it, and so Gwen and I said, oh, okay, we're kind of sick of L.A. anyway, let's pack up and go back to Utah. So that's what we did. You know, we packed up. We'd accumulate a little few more possessions in that 10 years, so we had to rent a U-Haul instead of cramming it in the Plymouth Horizon. But we, you know, made the trek back. And actually, interesting little tidbit there was, as we were driving back, just to play with keep myself occupied while I was driving the U-Haul. And I already knew that the film was going to be a success, you know, and I just thought, well, what if I get to make a God's Army 2, what would it be? And it was in the move to Utah to push God's Army that I came up with the idea for God's Army 2. And actually, as we were unpacking and everything in our new house, I remember stopping Gwen on the stairs and saying, okay, listen to this idea. And I told her the general story for God's Army 2, and she said, you can't do that. I said, no, I got to do this. Because it was basically the whole story, the gang story, the missionary falling from, you know.
From grace. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was the whole thing.
And the fact that there were other heroes that weren't necessarily Mormon.
Yeah. And she just thought, no, that you better not do that. That's just too much. And I thought, well, no, I think maybe the audience will be ready for it by the time I get to make it. But that's just a little tidbit.
Okay, before we go too much farther, I want to make sure. So we've kind of got the story of making it, and I didn't realize that you were at the time really already thinking Mormon cinema. I didn't know, you know, it was after God's Army came out that you started articulating that, but that was great to know. I just want to hear about the film itself. Clearly, you wanted to tell some kind of spiritual story,
right,
in addition to just a story that would appeal to the Mormon audience and therefore launch this thing called Mormon cinema.
Right.
So you were obviously playing with archetypes of different missionaries with different kind of battles. You were you had a story of healing. I know that was you've had a healing experience in your own life. I don't know if we want to talk about that now or later. So as far as just think about the story itself and the movie itself, and what are you most proud of? What were what was the big push?
Well, actually, before I do that, I got an email recently from somebody, it's probably on Facebook, somebody who found me on Facebook, and I think he was unacquainted with the fact that I'd left Mormonism, and so he really wrote me, and he just was calling me on the carpet, you know, saying, how can the maker of these movies, you know, not be LDS? And I think he didn't really seem to understand the fact that, you know, I'd made these films 1999, 2000, 2001, and he was talking to me in 2010, you know, so I was trying to explain to him my own evolution. But it was interesting to me that, and then I've had people ask me, are you ashamed of this movie now that your beliefs have evolved and changed, you've left the church, are you ashamed of these movies? Like, no, I'm not ashamed. God's Army, I love this movie. I'm so proud of it. You know, it's such a piece of me. It was such a sincere work. Very few films are this sincere. You know, people make movies, and most movies are kind of cynical, and, you know, you're making them for an audience, and you're just fulfilling an order. Or you get to sneak in a little bit of your own, you know, feelings or points of view. And this was this was just me opening up my heart and just saying, here it is. You know, this is, at this point in my life, this is what I believe. This is what I've experienced, you know. This is what I've come to understand. These are the questions I still have. And that's what this movie is for me. And so I am so, it was such a pure and sincere piece of filmmaking that, no, I love it. I'm so glad I made it. You know, And one of the comments I had of someone who reluctantly went to see the film, because again, there was a strange resistance to it, I think because it was a film.
So it wasn't a hit right away?
No, it was, but even...
But some people said no.
Yeah, I mean, some people that even though it was almost like they... It was the craziest, stupidest thing. It was so new that some people were still waiting for a general authority endorsement before they would go see it. But I remember one guy who was one of those guys who was in our ward in Mapleton, went to see it, and then the next Sunday he took me aside and he just thanked me so much for the film, and he said, and I love the way he put it, he said, it felt like you just, you know, opened up your chest and let everybody see what was inside. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly
that's what
it
felt
was.
Like. Yeah.
And,
neat.
And, yeah, so, and it was an interesting thing about, and I have a hard time saying there's anything I don't like about it. I mean, it's not the best film. I recognize that. You know, it's still a young filmmaker's film. There's a couple of little edits that don't work, you know, that, right? Because sometimes our budget showed through, and, you know, and there were some decisions I had to make in order to get the film done in time. So things like that, we're limited with music, and some of the music I would love to go redo, but still, I'm still very... very proud of it.
If you were to pick one or two scenes, what are your favorites? I mean, you've kind of told us the story and why some are memorable because of what was going on behind the scenes at the time and the stresses.
Right.
But I have a couple of favorites, so I want to hear what yours are, and maybe then I'll run one of mine by if it's not.
Well, I really don't have any scenes I don't like. I tend to like the scenes where something important comes across. I think the scene in the diner late at night after Elder Kinniger has left the mission, between Elder Dalton and Elder Allen, when they're sitting there having pie late at night, that conversation, that's one of my favorite scenes. I love things like the carrying the casket out through the airport hangar doors, just those shots and him being carried off into the light. That was a really... really beautiful thing. I like the humor in the film a lot. And I thought the actors, you know, I was happy with all of the actors pretty much.
And really, these are, for the most part, non-LDS actors. I remember
right.
you telling me only the mission president and just one or two of the other actors are actually LDS folks.
Yeah. And I found that I actually, interesting side note, when I thought the first place I should go cast would be BYU, because I thought here'd be all these returned missionaries, young actors in the acting program. And I came here and I auditioned, and it was awful. these people could not play themselves. You know, it was like they couldn't just be, I kept saying, just be normal. And they keep doing this, you know, this stereotype of what a missionary should be. And I cast one guy out of BYU. That was the guy that played Benny, the handicapped kid. The rest of them were just like, they, you know, and in contrast, when I was casting people in Los Angeles who didn't know anything about Mormon missionaries, anything, and they would kind of start off the same way because they would kind of do a priest thing, and I'd say, okay, forget that. This is
just
you.
These are 19, 20-year-old guys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I just say, don't do that. This is just you. And then, but they instantly understood that, whereas the LDS people couldn't. And casting wasn't difficult. It just took some time to find the right people, but we found an excellent cast. A lot of them I've used again and again.
Yes, yeah.
Out of loyalty, and because they're wonderful people, and because they're wonderful actors. But what are some of your favorite scenes?
Well, I mean, for as far as the mix of powerfulness, and then you still get the spirit, the fun of it all too, is the rooftop scene where a bunch of the missionaries are together having lunch, and it's right after Elder Banks has come back from, you know, getting the full force of Elder Banks. For those who haven't seen it, is a black missionary, and he's just been teaching a black couple who's just laid into him about that, and he's sharing his heart about his testimony and what it's based in and all that stuff. But then you cut to Elder Sandoval and he's just doing it. I can't remember why he's full of zeal, and all of a sudden he pops up and he's standing at the edge of the roof, and I'm Sandoval the Lamanite,
right.
And doing all that. Those are just that wonderful mixture of powerful stuff.
Oh, cool.
Deshaun Terry, who plays Elder Banks, is really my favorite actor that you've now used three different times. I think he's just really terrific, and one of my favorite scenes in States of Grace involves him as well.
Yeah, he is a great actor.
But anyway, the film is wonderful. If you haven't seen it, you've got to be. Everyone who's doing this is absolutely going to see this movie. I'm trying to think if I had any other questions about God's Army. I think it's neat to hear your passion for it and what you've said about the sincerity by with it, which it was made. That really is evident.
One of the things that's also was, coming up and the process from actually arriving, because, we arrived in Utah and I had basically the film under my arms and I just had to build. So that was the whole process too. If I would contact all the movie theaters and find out who their booking people were and sell them on the concept and because, this wasn't a common thing. It was.
And you're distributing this yourself.
Right.
You haven't got anybody else.
Right. Yeah. I started distributing that. And people at Excel, Jeff Simpson at Excel, was interested in distributing it, but they were taking so long, and I just started doing it myself. But basically just contacting the theater chains and saying, and they weren't based here. They were based in Dallas or Seattle or wherever, and saying, this is what I want to do, and I think it'll work because, the demographic here, this is a movie that they're going to like. And they said, well, send us the movie, and I'd send it, and they'd watch it and say, okay, all right, we'll give it a try. And so that's how it all started, and then being able to... and I knew basically nobody here, except my investors, and so here in Utah. And so it was a process of... I was just this guy that everyone was unaware of it. I was booking this film into theaters and creating the marketing materials, and I think somehow, I can't remember how I... Somebody said, you should let Gene England watch this movie. And Gene England was, I'd heard the name. I didn't know him personally, but I knew that he was really big in the Mormon scholarly community and very respected. And so I called, this is how it happened. It was Peggy Fletcher. That's how it happened. Peggy Fletcher Stack, who was a writer at the Tribune, who... I had contacted the newspapers because I wanted to start getting the word out that this movie was coming. And so she said, you should have Gene England watch it. And so I called Gene. And anyway, that's where things started to roll. Peggy Fletcher, so the Tribune broke the story about the film, that it was coming and it was going to open. Gene England saw it. I did a screening. That was my first Utah screening, I think, and Gene England and his wife Charlotte came. One of their sons showed up about halfway through. And... they came out very excited about it, and they started to spread the word, and then it started to snowball from there. And so the marketing effort was really fun. And again, I was just, I knew it was going to work. And so that was one of the really satisfying things, not only that it worked artistically, but, within the first weekend, two weekends, it had worked. And that was so gratifying, to be able to have been able to go back to all these people who said no, that they weren't going to support it. They didn't think it would work. And not so much to put it in their face, but just to say, look, this is it. This is what I was talking about. It was going to work. And so it was really gratifying to see it through, and that all the years of really scraping money for, just to make sure that we could eat and that we stayed in an apartment and that I could keep trying to raise money. To see it all pay off, it was so very gratifying, so very gratifying.
And ultimately, the box office was about $2 million, am I remembering right?
Yeah, about $2.7 million.
And then it's had a pretty decent sales through DVD.
It did
DVD.
About the same amount on DVD. And
so the investors were happy.
Investors were thrilled. And
and then from what you made, was that the money that you poured into Brigham City? At least some of it, or
no,
was it your own money, or did you? Again, I wanted to take a break before you and I dig into the rest of your.
This is a good segue because no, it wasn't. I put a little money into Brigham City, but what I did with that money was actually it takes a while for that money to come in, from the theaters and from the DVDs and all of that stuff. So when I made Brigham City, I made it completely independently. Some of the same investors came in, and then Larry Miller came in, and what I did instead was the money that came in from God's Army, when I was suddenly, becoming a wealthy man, was I made what ultimately turned out to be a very poor financial decision, was I put all of that money into the film on Joseph Smith.
Which we will definitely, listeners, talk about. That was the number one question as we put the word out. They wanted to know about that project. So we'll talk about it, but now just tell us this.
But I was very full of, you know, faith and zeal. And I, every time, you know, it's like I'd put myself out on the limb with Girl Crazy. I put myself out on the limb with God's Army. It worked. And so I was ready to, you know, make the ultimate act of faith and make this film on Joseph Smith. And so I once again did what I... what life experience had taught me to do. I should have been more wise and recognized that it was conditional. But again, once again, I was filled with a sense of purpose and mission, and of course it was going to work, and so I was willing to take everything that came in and put it into that film. And I think that would be a good time for a break.
Okay, can I ask one more question first?
Okay.
Just because God's Army, it dawned on me that one thing we haven't covered, the humor, the missionary humor, the insider, you know, parting the veil on missionaries joking around and messing around with each other. And then also, it was startling, and there was a reaction in the Mormon community for the fact that you were showing our ordinances.
Right.
Which, you know, I know you have reactions to both of those kinds of things. Can you give us 2 minutes on each or something?
Yeah. That was tricky, because I knew one of the things that was important to me was when I went into this idea of telling... of something called Mormon cinema, I knew that I couldn't... There were things that I'd seen other Mormon filmmakers do, which you'd call them Mormon filmmakers because they were Mormon and they were working in film, but they weren't doing anything that had anything to do with Mormonism. And whenever they would approach a Mormon story, they would strip it of all of its Mormonism. And so there would be ministers that could have been anything. In fact, you didn't know what they were because they were so generic. And so as I was kind of studying this, getting ready to make my own film, I realized that was something that was... I thought that neutered a story. I thought that generic approach just... and I started to look at the stories that really resonated spiritually with me, and they were, you know, whether it was like Chaim Potok stuff from, you know, his writing, which was so culturally specific and so foreign to me, and yet...
It's such a universal story. Yeah,
right.
The Chosen and Asher Lev and all those things.
But because he was
the more specific you are, the better you can go universal.
Right, the more culturally specific you can be, the more universal it can become, because then it's a real person, and it might not be somebody that it might not be you or your community, but it's a real person. And so I knew that I'd have to do the same thing. And what were the things that made Mormonism different from other religions? And from a Mormon doctrinal standpoint, what made us different? And it was the priesthood, it was the ordinances, all the things that we didn't show, and so I knew I'd have to do that. And I struggled with that. I mean, people think a lot of people criticized me because they thought I was just offhanded about it, and I was anything but. You know, again, I was venturing into waters that people hadn't gone into. And so I was struggling with that for a long time. It was like, okay, if I show an ordinance, having an actor who's not a Mormon perform an ordinance, am I committing some sin? Showing it, am I violating him? Is this sacrilegious? I went through all of that stuff and came to my own conclusions and then went for it, you know? And the one thing, and it's interesting, film, we can go into this a lot, especially when we get talking about Evil Angel and Falling, is film for me also is there's a element of experimentation and exploration where when I made God's Army, I hadn't shot an ordinance. There's an interesting story. I don't know if we have time to go into that, but I went into it. It's like you kind of have to test the waters, you know, and trust your own instincts and your own conscience, your own sense of what's right and wrong. Because I went into it and basically testing is like, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to shoot it. And it's a good thing about film too, is where you can try something, and if it doesn't work, or if you feel you've done something wrong, it doesn't have to end up in the film, you know. So that was an experimentation for me. And in fact, when I got to the point of the baptisms, I was like, shoot the, you know, just shoot it, just shoot it. Just no cuts, no problem like this. Also, I think if I remember correctly, it was just my character that you see perform the baptism where you actually hear something. I can't remember now. It's been so long. But anyway, I shot the baptisms with the real, you know, ordinance dialogue that you would use. And but then when I shot the healing scene, I was careful to break it up so that We'd never actually be performing the ordinance, so, you know, we'd...
Oh, so you don't quite, yeah, you don't,
you know what I mean?
Do all the different parts of it, but you do enough of it, yeah.
Right, so saying, it's like, yeah. I would start the thing off, and I would start it off, and I'd get halfway through. And, of course, we're using oil, but it's not really consecrated oil. All these things that I was doing to be careful and and just kind of test my, as we went along. And so, you know, so I'd do half the ordinance, and then I would cut, and then I would do another half, and just make sure that it was all broken up, just... Mm-hmm. Because, again, I was just kind of experimenting. By the time I, and then I got through and I realized, wow, it's no big deal. And I understood when I was putting the film together, it's like, it's all, I mean, what, God doesn't know that you're acting? Of course he knows you're acting, you know? And to me, it was more important. It's like, what's the most, you know, what am I trying to portray? Where's my heart? Where's my, what are my motivations, you know? And I wasn't trying to mock these things. In fact, anything
absolutely
but.
Absolutely not. Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
I was honoring these things. These are things that were just special and wonderful. And so, by the end of that, it was like, no, I have no problems at all. So when I went into Brigham City, it was just like, you know,
sacrament, no problem.
Yeah, problems at all. I would shoot any ordinance, and I would have non-Mormons doing it, and who cares? I mean, it's all...
Well, yeah, and when you think about it, we've seen enough films of these culturally specific different religions. We've seen last rites millions of times on the film. We've seen bar mitzvahs. We've seen...
Confessions.
Lots of, marriage ceremonies and whatnot. And so...
Really, but you see,
it's our turn.
But from a Mormon's perspective, I mean, a Latter-day Saint would say, "Well, they don't have a problem with you showing the Catholics because those aren't real."
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, that's okay. I hadn't thought about that.
And that's why. But
those
aren't
efficacious.
Exactly. That's why they're touchy about their own, is because these are the real ones. You know?
Okay.
So you don't show these.
Interesting.
I became very comfortable with it. In fact, I felt it was an essential part of Mormon storytelling, is you have to show these things because these are the things that make Mormonism unique. And they either carry some weight, and the symbolism and the meaning behind them, good heavens, if you're a Mormon storyteller, to not use them is stupid. It's like, you know, it's painting without paint.
Right, you're in the direst health situations here, of course you're going to go to administering to the sick, and it would just be crazy not to. It would
which is one of the things that as I was doing this, I was very consciously, you know, making these steps and learning these things, and so I was less than respectful when other filmmakers came along after me and were going through the process that I had already gone through. But I was just trying to tell them, hey, catch up, guys. It's like, you know, I wasn't allowing them time to learn the things that I had learned. And so, like, when Mitch Davis did Other Side of Heaven, which really was a, you know, pretty good film and production-wise, but when he did his whole blessing thing and was stepping away from the, again, stepping away from the specifics of the ordinance and doing, you know, an odd thing, you know, breathe in, breathe out, that I didn't even understand what he was doing. I remember being very, you know, it's like, I was impatient with that because I was like, Mitch, you know, we already solved this like 3 years ago. Get with the program. You can do an ordinance. Just do it, you know?
Yeah. And then, again, it's culturally specific to make it universal. The humor. God's Army is full of the inside missionary stuff, like, if you don't look once, you're not a man.
Right.
If you look more than once at the pretty girl, you're not a missionary.
Right.
You know, messing around, telling... leprosy jokes, you know, as well as filming a guy quickly grabbing a candid shot while he's on the toilet. You took criticism for it, but to me, it is in service of what you're just talking about. You've got to make it true to life and very specific to the kinds of things that go on.
Yeah, none of the criticisms bothered me at all because I was very confident about the story. And again, I'd made all the decisions. This was so well thought through. That to me, I was able to listen to the criticisms and understand to a point where they're coming from, but not let it bother me. One of the things that I think that we've neglected, there's so much to talk about, but one of the things we've neglected to talk about, which was another really motivating force for me, was I was so sick of the way other people portrayed Mormonisms and Mormons. Before 2000, you know, there was, whenever Mormons were portrayed on the screen, we were portrayed as weirdos, you know, I mean, just like born-again Christians. Not that born-again Christians are weirdos, but we were portrayed wrong.
It was caricatures. Like they didn't even take the
time to understand the things, the, you know, the way that how Mormons were different from everybody else. And so Mormons were always just the psychos, the weirdos, the wimps. And so I was so fed up with it that was one of the motivating factors of telling the story too. It's like, why are we letting other people tell our stories? And they're getting it wrong all the time. And so inevitably, you know, and so I wanted to put it out there. It's like, okay, this, you know, let's start telling our stories and showing us the way that we really are. And let's start, instead of letting other people tell our doctrine and our history and our community, let's tell it ourselves. And that was a real motivating force for me. And which also led to some of the conflict later that I had with some of the other LDS filmmakers, because I think, again, I wanted to show what was best and deepest and most beautiful about Mormonism. And then just yahoos came along and started wanting to, you know, make fun of us. And it's like, they've been making fun of us for 100 years. Why are you wanting to make fun of us?
We have more powerful stories than...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can tell these amazing stories, and you guys are wanting to tell this. But that was a... And I was really gratified to see that we did... Because most, you know, 90% of the audience that saw God's Army was LDS, undoubtedly, you know, but it did bring in other people. And it was such a independent film success story, and the numbers were out there. So people, you know, people in the independent film community and broader film community were aware of it, because it was like, wow, here's this movie that was made for next to nothing. And it's, you know, within a couple of weeks, it's, you know, it's just exploded. And of course, as soon as it did well in Utah, we were able to play nationwide. And so it really showed up on people's radar, and I like to think that one of my motivations was to show the Hollywood community that there was this demographic that up until now, you know, they were satisfied to just make fun of, but if they started to realize that it was a real demographic of people that bought tickets, you know, and
they
went to the movies,
yeah,
that they might start being laying off a little bit and stop making fun of us and doing some more positive things. And I did. I have seen that happen, and I like to think that the movie, and I know that the movie did contribute to a certain degree, to a certain change, where not that the Mormons are all that well portrayed now, but it's certainly a lot better than it was in 1995, you know, and there's certainly a lot more understanding of the, you know, broadness and complexity, and I think... A little more. I think Mormons are considered a little more interesting,
and media-wise. Human. Yeah,
media-wise.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Well, thanks. That's wonderful.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.